EU coordinator Enrique Mora said there were moderate advances, adding that with more detail comes more complexity. While the US delegation led by Robert Malley has been engaged in negotiations in Vienna, there's been no direct talks between Iran and the US. Delegates have decided to have further consultations in their respective capitals before returning for another joint commission session here at the end of next week. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in the Gaza Strip after the Friday prayers in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds and its people. The Hamas movement organized a mass rally. The protesters slammed the acts of violence done by Israeli forces in Jerusalem al-Quds and expressed solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories.
Jerusalem al-Quds has always been our main cause of conflict and the destination of all the resistance and revolutions. We will not accept the Israeli regime's attempts to Judaize al-Quds by expelling and killing its people and demolishing their houses. Al-Quds is known for its brave men and women.
We are here to stress on our support to protesters in Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to tell them that we are here feeling what they feel and we will be all gathered to liberate Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds. I call on the international community to stand by our people in Al-Aqsa and support them against the inhumane Israeli regime.
The mass rally in Gaza, which occurred for a second Friday in a row, was triggered by Israeli restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and the regime's crackdown on protesters against the restrictions. The protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed not to remain silent to the Israeli aggression against their brothers and sisters.
This is a message to our people in Jerusalem al-Quds that we will keep supporting and defending you against the Israeli occupation. We won't sit idle until seeing Al-Aqsa free and raising the flags of Palestine in Al-Quds. We are all united on the road of resistance against this occupation.
Palestinians consider resistance as the only way to respond to all Israeli violations and a key to liberating the occupied Palestinian territory.
In the middle of the holy month of Ramadan, the historic Jama Mosque in Srinagar, the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir, wears a deserted look. So are the other religious places across the region. Amid rapid surge in COVID cases, the religious bodies here have suspended congregational prayers and other religious gatherings.
We should understand the present situation. We request everyone to offer prayers at home instead of going to mosques. In this holy month, let's all pray for those affected by this virus and for an end to the pandemic.
Authorities in Kashmir have imposed lockdown to curb a surge in COVID infections and deaths. The announcement to impose lockdown came after the region recorded 700% increase in active COVID infections in this month alone, sending the alarm bells ringing. Officials have already banned gathering of more than four people, but essential services have been exempted from the lockdown. Authorities claim that there is no shortage of oxygen, medicines and COVID vaccine in the region, saying the government is handling the COVID situation effectively. But some people blame authorities for their late response to the pandemic.
There was no robust system of testing at the airport, at the Srinagar airport. And the biggest problem in our case was that the government and the administration here threw open Tulip Garden and organized other Khelo programs, mass gatherings, fashion shows. So this was to showcase normalcy. And in the process, what happened that from 50 odd cases per day, now we are here where we have more than 3,000 cases on a daily basis. And there are 30 plus deaths.
India, the world's second most populous nation, remains in deep crisis as hospitals and morgues are overwhelmed by the pandemic, with medicine and oxygen in short supply and strict limits on movement imposed in the country's largest cities.
The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic is causing a steep rise in the number of infections and posing a huge challenge for health experts and the government here. Experts have warned that the fight against the pandemic is far from over and have urged the people not to drop their guard against the deadly virus. Sayyidis of Indian-administered Kashmir.
A Palestinian refugees and Lebanese factions have held several gatherings in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds. Lebanese political representatives denounced the Israeli aggressive practices, both in the occupied territories and the besieged Gaza Strip.
So we are here today to say to the world, and to especially to the Arab people, not the Arab leaders, that they should unite and stand against what's happening. They should be united against the crimes against humanity we are seeing. Innocent people are being bombarded every day. Innocent kids and people are being killed every day, and nobody's lifting a finger.
Palestinian factions stress that as long as Palestinians are able to protect their historic right to their homeland, then there is no fear that Israel or any collaborators can steal it away.
The battle for Al-Quds is a battle on behalf of the entire nation, so the least we can do is to give support to this intifada. This is an extension of several uprisings since 2015 and until today. The occupation forces want to grasp control over the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its surroundings. Palestinian protesters need support, and today we tell them that the Al-Quds is not alone. We saw the support from the West Bank and Gaza to Al-Quds, which shows that Jerusalem Al-Quds won't be left alone.
The speech is noted that all the resistance factions, whether in Lebanon or Palestine, and the entire resistance bloc, united stands with the Palestinian people in their fight for freedom and life.
Your steadfastness is a humiliation to the occupation. We stand with you every single day, and soon we will liberate Palestine.
I tell our brothers in Al-Quds that God is with you, and this means no one can defeat you. I tell all the people of Palestine, hold on, victory is near. You're the rightful owners of this land.
Protests and confrontations broke out in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds after Israeli authorities decided to break a pledge of respecting the right to worship by forcing their way into Al-Aqsa Mosque's four minarets in order to silence the evening call to prayers. The Israeli violence has evoked anger across the Arab and Muslim worlds.
A salute to Jerusalem Al-Quds and the steadfastness of the Palestinian people in the Holy Land is what Lebanese and Palestinian activists have gathered for today. And despite all blockades and Israeli aggressive policies, they stress that the younger generations will resist more than ever before. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
After a still deeply disputed election, new United States President Joe Biden has reached 100 days in office with a lower approval rating than any other newly elected president since 1953, excepting Donald Trump. Many believe the country is only in a temporary political calm, which could be broken with the reported return of Trump to the political rally circuit in May.
Well, I don't know if the honeymoon is over. I think in some cases the honeymoon was over a few days after the inauguration, or even before the inauguration.
Biden finally gave his address, where he also unveiled a 10-year social infrastructure plan, which is expected to get many months of pushback from Congress. Many say Biden has had some successes. The coronavirus vaccine distribution, the $2 trillion infrastructure plan, ending the Muslim travel ban, and returning to the Paris Climate Agreement. But Biden has already backtracked from campaign promises in many vital areas. The fight for $15 per hour, the amount and length of unemployment payments, total household stimulus payments, dropping Medicare eligibility to 60 years old, student debt relief, reversing Trump's tax cuts for the rich, and more.
He's reneged on everything he promised, and he comes up with an excuse. I can't do it, or we can't do it because one guy's voting against it. We can't do it because the parliamentarian has decided we can't put it in the bill. I mean, people are pretty much aware that these are lame excuses, and that the Democrats, and Biden especially, are just using these lame excuses to not do what they said they would do.
At 100 days and amid similar economic disaster, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had passed 15 major bills which established hugely influential initiatives. Contrarily, Biden's $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package didn't establish a single long-term program. On foreign policy, Biden has adopted almost all of the stances of his controversial predecessor. He has not lifted sanctions on Iran nor returned to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. Russia's foreign minister said Biden's refusal of diplomacy and lack of respect could make relations worse than even during the Cold War. He has not taken Cuba off the state terrorist list, and he adopted Trump's widely criticized low quota for asylum seekers, despite a crisis on the southern border. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khakdaman.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, hello and welcome to our program. I'm very happy to have another chance talking to you about the Ahkam in month of Ramadan. Well, the previous episode I talked a little bit about traveling and being a traveler and passenger and what are the influences and consequences that it has in Ahkam regarding prayers, regarding our specific topic, which is month of Ramadan and fasting. This time I'm going to look at it from another window, from another perspective, and that's the fact that the whole traveling thing in month of Ramadan is advised not to do, or as we say in our religion language, it's makruh, means it's advised not to do it, it's advised to avoid it. Now why is it? Because the intentions and aims are different in this matter. Some people travel in month of Ramadan because they want to go to a place which has a better weather. It's cooler, it's easier to tolerate the hunger and the thirst of Ramadan. Some people go to another city. They travel only because of pulling the obligation of fasting, not to fast, because probably the days are long and it is hard for them to fast. Some people want to travel to be with their relatives and to have other experiences or have fun or in any way actually hinder and weaken the experience and the difficulty of this hardship of thirst and hunger and the other limitations that we have in month of Ramadan. When you study and think, especially when you go to the Holy Prophet and his household, peace be upon them all, when you go to their accounts and study about the special characteristics of month of Ramadan, about the qualities that it has, about the open hands of God, about the mercies and blessings and extra givings that God has in this month, you don't want to deprive yourself of these possessions. You don't want to come out of it with your pocket empty, right? So I know that there are some necessary trips, and I will be talking about them. There are some exceptions. There are a couple of travels that are very, very recommended to do. The Holy Prophet has recommended them, and we're going to talk about them. But a lot of travels that are done in this month are not because of our religious purposes, are done probably because it is hard to fast. But when you think about, for example, this fact that in the period of fasting, the Muslim that is fasting, whatever he wants, God will give that person. The activities that you do are accepted. The prayers that you do are heard, and God will answer to you. When you think about them, you don't want to lose this opportunity. But at the end, there are some exceptions. For example, going on a pilgrimage. For example, going to Karbala or Medina or Mashhad, to these sacred places to as a pilgrim, right? To the shrines of Imams, peace be upon them. These are not normal trips. These are not travels that are going to, you know, take something from us. No, they are going to give us much more. So if you find opportunity in the month of Ramadan to go on a pilgrimage to Imam's shrines, for example, the shrine of Imam Hussein or Imam Ridha or Amir al-Mu'minin, peace be upon them all, go absolutely. Don't let any kind of doubt or confusion come to your mind. It is very recommended. But if traveling is because of otherworldly purposes, then it's really best for you to avoid them. Thank you so very much and goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. In the last 10 days of this month, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to get prepared for further worship. It is narrated that he paid a special attention to i'tikaf in the blessed month of Ramadan. He would adhere to this tradition in every Ramadan. But in the year that the Battle of Badr took place, he couldn't do this as the war was in the month of Ramadan. Therefore, the Prophet performed i'tikaf for 20 days, to compensate for the year before. As you know, the pilgrims of the symbolic house of God in Mecca, Kaaba, have to refrain from certain things when they want to enter the sacred mosque. When they wear the special garb, ihram, more than 20 things become forbidden for them. Ramadan is similar to Hajj, as certain things become forbidden for the person who fasts. The fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, says, Almighty God has made the month of Ramadan superior to other months with ample respects and famous virtues. Thus, a series of things that were halal in other months have been forbidden for reverence and respect of this month. And he has prohibited eating and drinking in this month for ennoblement of Ramadan. Dear listeners, no doubt, a person who stays in a mosque for i'tikaf in Ramadan will be more favored by God. According to the Islamic jurisprudence, material and financial atonement of fasting should be given to the poor. This can be given to poor relatives, but is forbidden to give it to one's family members who receive alimony. If the atonement is paid as money, it should be paid to charity institutions to buy food and give to poor people. The money for atonement cannot be spent for other uses such as cultural and social uses. The money shouldn't be less than the price of 750 grams of wheat. A patient who suffers from a chronic disease and cannot fast till the end of Ramadan or the next Ramadan, fasting as compensation is not obligatory for him, but he has to give 750 grams of wheat or rice and so on for each day. Dear friends, as we have said earlier, on the eve of the 19th of the blessed month of Ramadan in 40 AH, the renegade Abdurrahman ibn Muljam struck Imam Ali's head with a poisonous sword while the Imam was in mihrab, that is the niche of the mosque of Kufa. Imam Ali, peace upon him, was so dear for the Prophet of Islam and enjoyed such a lofty position with God that the Prophet would benefit any opportunity to inform people of his status. Once, he said to Imam Ali, "You are to me like Aaron to Moses, except that there will be no messenger after me." This hadith proves all merits of Aaron for Imam Ali, except that there won't be any messenger after Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The Prophet used to emphasize that Imam Ali would be the next leader of the Ummah after him. He said time and again that Imam Ali had been designated by God as the Prophet's vicegerent and the first Imam of the Ummah. Let us place God on oath by the lofty status of Imam Ali on these nights to forgive our sins and help us follow the Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt, his infallible progeny, peace upon them. Now let us recite a supplication that has been recommended for the eve of the 21st of the blessed month of Ramadan. O inserter of the night in the day and inserter of the day in the night, and bringer of the living out of the dead, and bringer of the dead out of the living. O provider of whomever you want without reckoning. O God, O compassionate. O God, O merciful, O God, O God, O God, you have the best names and lofty comparisons and grandeurs and bounties. I plead to you to bless Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad and place my name on this night among the successful and my spirit among the martyrs and my good deed among the inhabitants of the highest point of paradise. And forgive my evil deeds, and I plead to you to grant me certitude, which accompanies with my heart, and faith, which takes doubt away from me, and make me satisfied with what you have distributed for me, and give us good in the world and good in the hereafter, and guard us against the punishment of burning fire, and give me a sustenance on this night, your remembrance and your gratitude, an enthusiasm toward you and returning to you, and assisting me in what you have assisted Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad. Greetings to him and them.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked and
the Holy Prophet of Islam
is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
مثلا درک شب قدر یعنی چی؟ درک شب قدر فقط بیدار بودن نیست، ممکنه تو عالم خیلی همون شب بیدار باشن، ولی به صرف بیدار بودن که اون چیزا گیرشون نمیاد.
What does it mean by true recognition of the night of Qadr? Recognizing the night of Qadr does not mean keeping vigil during that night, because there are many people across the world who are awake on such a night. The night of Qadr is in fact for the infallible Wali of Allah on earth. This is the night when Allah has prepared a special banquet for His Wali on earth. Ahlul Bayt have emphasized very much on reciting Surah Al-Qadr in our Salat. They also invited their foes to ponder upon the verses of this Surah. We can call Surah Al-Qadr as the Surah of Al-Wilaya. There is no reference to the words Wilaya or Wali in this Surah. So, which part of this surah refers to the concept of wilaya?
امام باقر علیه السلام فرمودن اینجاش که شما تو این سوره قدر میگید تنزل الملائکه و روح فيها بإذن ربهم من كل أم.
Imam al-Baqir states, in the Holy Quran, Surah al-Qadr, Ayah 4, we read, in it, the angels and the spirit descend by the leave of their Lord with every command. This means that all the angels descend on the night of Qadr. Now, the question is, where do these angels go? Angels are immaterial beings, so they cannot descend on the land like an airplane. The immaterial being, like an angel, has to descend on an immaterial entity like himself. The angels descend on the souls. Now, which soul has the capacity to tolerate the presence of angels, including Gabriel in itself? Not every soul is capable of bearing the immaterial beings like angels and archangels. This shows that there's an infallible Wali of Allah on earth, and He is the only being that can bear the descent of immaterial beings like divine angels on Himself. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com. Call our Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The first Palestinian national election in 15 years has been indefinitely delayed. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas made the announcement following a meeting with Ramallah-based political factions on Thursday. Abbas blamed Israel and the uncertainty about whether it would allow the vote to take place in the occupied West Bank and Gaza for the decision.
Facing this difficult situation, we decided to postpone the date of holding legislative elections until the participation of Jerusalem and its people is guaranteed. Jerusalem will not be compromised, and our people in Jerusalem will not give up their right to exercise their democratic rights.
The decision came 3 months after he issued a formal decree ordering a vote for the Palestinian legislature on May 22nd, and a Palestinian presidential election on July 31st, votes that could serve as an acid test for the legitimacy of the Palestinian political institutions, including his own presidency. Many observers believe the indefinite postponement is effectively a cancellation of the vote.
In my opinion, the best thing the Palestinian Authority can do is to dissolve itself. Anyone who tries to represent Palestinians today is compromised in some way, either because they are cooperating with the Israeli occupiers and oppressors, or because they can only operate if they're opposing them, as Hamas is. They can operate only within certain parameters because they're denied the ability to operate the way they would like to operate.
Hundreds of Palestinians staged a protest in Ramallah to denounce the decision. They chanted slogans calling for the formation of a legitimate government. Earlier in the day, hundreds of people had staged rallies in the Gaza Strip to condemn the Palestinian Authority chief's plans to call off the vote. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, denounced Abbas's decision, calling it, quote, a coup. In a statement, Hamas said the move goes against the path of partnership and national consensus, issues that cannot be pawned as collateral for the agenda of a faction. It also noted that the Fatah movement and the Palestinian president bear full responsibility for the decision and its consequence. In a separate statement, head of Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, condemned as unconvincing the decision, demanding that the elections of the Legislative Council, the Palestinian Authority, and the National Council be held at agreed schedules. He added that the resistance movement is ready to cooperate with all Palestinian political factions.
A Hamas win might be satisfying to many. It might be satisfying in the sense that it confronts Israel and that it stands up for Palestinian rights, or but in fact, a Hamas win means probably more oppression and less opportunity from the Israeli side, and it will be used, it very possibly will be used as a pretext for Israel to be even more oppressive and to accelerate their genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestine, because their ultimate objective is to have no Palestinians in Palestine.
Israeli authorities have made many efforts to either cancel or postpone the polls. Israeli forces have escalated an arrest campaign targeting key Hamas figures in the West Bank in recent months. Observers are drawing a parallel between the recent arrests and those made in the run-up to the 2006 elections, which resulted in a sweeping victory for Hamas.
International rights group has accused Israel of pursuing policies of apartheid and persecution against the Palestinian people. Human Rights Watch says the policies amount to crimes against humanity. In a 213-page report, the HRW points to Israeli restrictions on Palestinians' movements and land grabs for the construction of settlements in the territories occupied in 1967, calling them examples of policies that are crimes of apartheid. The rights group said Israeli authorities have pursued intent to maintain domination over Palestinians by exercising control over land and demographics for the benefit of Israelis across the occupied territories. HRW called on the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute individuals credibly implicated in the apartheid and persecution. This says just a few weeks back, the court said it would investigate war crimes by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. This brings to the spotlight the fact that the regime has continued with its violation of Palestinians' rights for decades amid silence of the West in dealing with such crimes.
Well, I think it's very welcome. It really doesn't, to those of us who have any familiarity with the reality on the ground there, there are no real revelations, nothing new. And one of the thoughts that comes to mind is what's taken them so long to acknowledge these realities. But nevertheless, it's welcome that they are acknowledging them now, I think. And the report in particular, I haven't had a chance to read every word of it, but I've skimmed through it and read the summary and so on. One of the things it does that I think the previous statements in this area have not done is to subject to do a pretty rigorous analysis of what international law actually says, and to make the case that the realities in Palestine actually match the international legal definitions of these crimes against humanity, specifically the crime of apartheid, and something that was new to me as a legal concept, the crime of persecution.
The report by the Human Rights Watch comes as even Israeli advocacy groups have accused Israel of being an apartheid regime. Just a few months back, advocacy group B'Tselem said that Israel is an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws. B'Tselem said the regime in Tel Aviv uses laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another. It added the Israeli apartheid, which promotes the supremacy of Jews over Palestinians, was not born in one day or of a single speech. The group added this is a process that has gradually grown more institutionalized and explicit, with mechanisms introduced over time in law and practice to promote Jewish supremacy.
You know, it's true that it has gradually been more institutionalized and consolidated. On the other hand, I have to say, I first went to the occupied territories, specifically, to both the West Bank and to Gaza in 2002, and I don't claim any special enlightenment, but all this was pretty obvious to me back in 2002. So, you know, it takes a long time for these groups to face up to the reality, which was pretty clear to me way back then.
Israel occupied the West Bank and East Jerusalem of Al-Quds during the Six-Day War in 1967. It later annexed East Jerusalem al-Quds in a move not recognized by the international community. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state with East Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's aggressive settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. Meanwhile, the Gaza Strip has been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea blockade since 2007 and witnessed three wars since 2008.
Of course, they're outrageous and shocking, and no other country in the world would be able to go on with impunity and continue to be acknowledged as a great democracy and to get billions of dollars in U.S. aid every year and so on and so on. It's, you know, frankly, I think it's because of the power of the Zionist forces and the political power, cultural power of the Zionist forces in the United States that makes this all possible.
That said, what better characterizes Israel's apartheid practices are Tel Aviv's violations, including unlawful killings, forced displacement, abusive detention, the siege of the Gaza Strip, and other unjustified restrictions on movement and the expansion of settlements. However, what can only bring the Israeli apartheid policies to an end is a united front by the international community against such practices that are only aimed at dislodging the Palestinians from their land, namely Palestine.
Ethnic minority students have for long been victims of institutional racism in the universities of Britain. However, it seems British universities have not done enough to combat the racism, as their students believe that their complaints were mishandled. According to a Guardian report, universities fail to handle tens of thousands of complaints about racist incidents annually. A research from the Equalities and Human Rights Commission was published in 2009. Revealed some interesting yet embarrassing facts about racism at UK universities. The research suggested that one in four of the students participating in the survey had experienced racial harassment since their course started. Also, one in 20 students said that they left their course because of it. Moreover, two-thirds of students who experienced racial harassment avoided reporting it to their university. They were mainly concerned about being labeled as a troublemaker or feared that the complaint could affect their course or believed the university would not take it seriously. Meanwhile, a report from the university's UK organization says that British universities are continuing to perpetuate institutional racism. The report also highlights a range of issues, including a lack of diversity among senior leaders, minority ethnic student attainment gap, and ethnicity pay gaps among staff. Only about 110 out of the over 18,000 UK university professors are black. In addition, only 3.2% of academic managers, directors, and senior officials are from ethnic minorities, and they are paid 16% less than UK-domiciled white officials and managers. Furthermore, black undergraduates have higher dropout rates. Professor David Richardson, the University of East Anglia's vice chancellor, who leads the university's UK's advisory group on racial harassment, says that British universities are institutionally racist. He acknowledged that racial harassment in universities is underreported and stressed the importance of providing support for the ethnic minority students.
Well, I think that people forget that the UK is still really a post-colonial nation. It's a post-imperialist nation in many ways, although that's arguable. And that carries with it its natural issues and problems. For instance, a lot of the, for instance, migrant issues, which are a fear factor and also a hatred. And you've seen an exponential rise in racism and racist political movements.
46-year-old African-American George Floyd died on May 25 in the northern U.S. city of Minneapolis after a white police officer pressed his knee on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. He continually gasped, "Please, can't breathe," until his heart stopped. This incident triggered massive outrage against police brutality and racial prejudice. Demonstrators across the world have staged rallies in solidarity.
rallies known as the Black Lives Matter protests swept the UK last year as well. Protesters in Britain toppled or removed statues of slave traders, including that of Edward Colston in Bristol. They also vandalized a memorial to Winston Churchill in central London with the words, "Was a racist." There has since been a public reckoning with Britain's slavery and colonial past. The protests forced British authorities to take down or to remove scores of tributes to slave traders, colonialists, and racists across the UK.
Well, let me give one example, and it's linked to this university report that you've covered. Basically, let's take Oxford and Cambridge as institutions which are well known around the world, global institutions known for their so-called excellence in education. Well, they've been failing the black communities in particular almost systemically, and this institutional systemic structural racism is where the real danger lies.
Following the Black Lives Matter protest, a research shows the number of black people who said they have faced racial discrimination last year increased from 74% in 2019 to 81%. While the UK's past is not hidden from anyone, the Black Lives Matter movement shed light on one of the biggest faults within the body of this former colonial power, and that is racism.
The Israeli violation of the rights of Palestinians does not seem to abate. In the latest development, the regime fully closed Gaza's fishing zone, preventing Palestinians from sailing off the besieged enclave. Israeli authorities said the total closure was in response to rocket attacks from the Gaza Strip. They said five rockets were fired from Gaza at Israel overnight. But the decision comes as fishing is a significant source of income for many Gazans. The size of the fishing zone has varied over the years. It was set at 20 nautical miles by the Oslo Peace Accords in the 1990s before being reduced to 6 miles under the joint Israeli-Egyptian blockade in 2007. This, as the measure, is not enough for doing any fishing in the first place. But the Israeli regime has raised and lowered the limit several times in recent years in a bid to pressure the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas.
Israeli policy towards Gazans and their fishing industry has long been part of their plan to periodically crush Gazans and to keep the economy on life supports. I think we also have to look at the current situation in the framing of what's going on in Israel, that there is recently been an election, that Netanyahu is trying to put together a group of cohorts that will create a majority in the Knesset, and that he will often create military issues or heighten military tensions in order to increase his popularity and to get people to rally around him. So I think it's a combination of their longstanding policies and the current situation in the electorate in Israel.
The decision to fully shut the fishing zone to the Palestinians comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called for the military to prepare for any scenario regarding the Gaza Strip. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz also echoed Netanyahu's remarks, saying Israeli forces will do whatever necessary to quote, preserve calm. Israel's closure of the fishing zone limits what little the blockaded territory has for its food supplies. According to figures, there are some 4,000 fishermen registered in the Gaza Strip who are breadwinners of some 50,000 people. This, however, is something misleading, as half of those registered are actually out of work. 95% of Gaza fishermen population lives under the poverty line. Many of them rely on humanitarian aid and belong to the 80% of Gaza's overall population who rely on such aid. But the closure of the fishing zone is not the only nightmare the Palestinians live with. The Israeli regime has put nearly 3 million people under a tight land, sea, and air blockade since 2007, bringing almost the entire population to starvation. The blockade targets Gaza's vital infrastructure, including water, energy, health, and other sectors, complicating the already dire humanitarian situation there. Gaza's health sector, for instance, is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies. Many believe this is itself a war crime in its own form and must be stopped.
So the issue of whether the behavior of the Israeli government and military comprise various war crimes is one that has been debated and exposed repeatedly, and there are now questions in front of the International Criminal Court, and I think that they will obviously come up with an opinion themselves. Personally, I find much of the behavior of the Israeli government and the military towards the 2.2 million Gazans can be characterized as various kinds of war crimes.
Meanwhile, the blockade has exacerbated further with COVID-19 ravaging the Gaza Strip. This brings to the spotlight the fact that the blockade and sufferings of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are going unnoticed.
Well, the Gazans have long been invisible on the world stage. Many of us have tried to highlight the exacerbations of the humanitarian catastrophe in view of the COVID-19 pandemic. But it's part of a longstanding pattern of valuing Jewish Israeli lives over the lives of Palestinians living in Gaza. And I think this is a combination of both medical apartheid and racism and Islamophobia and forces like that that shape international opinion.
What is questionable, however, is that the international community must have a role in bringing Palestinian sufferings to an end, and humanitarian efforts must gain momentum to get the blockade lifted. This includes international legal bodies like the International Criminal Court, which can play a key role in calling Israel to account over its decades-long crimes against the Palestinian people.
يا ليلة القدر يا فضل بارنا خير من الدهر بالعفو تاتنا
يا ليلة القدر يا فضل بارنا
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, The Night of Power, Laylatul Qadr. In the book Iqbal, a tradition has been narrated from the Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He says that Prophet Moses in his prayer said, O Allah, I desire your nearness and union. My nearness and union belong to someone who remains vigilant and awake during the night of power, replied Allah. Prophet Moses said, O Allah, I want your blessing and forgiveness. My blessing belongs to someone who is kind towards the destitute on the night of power, replied Allah. Prophet Moses said, O Allah, I want to pass through the bridge of Sirat on the road to paradise safely. The safety in passing through the bridge of Sirat belongs to someone who pays alms on the night of power, again replied Allah. Prophet Moses said, O Allah, I want the trees and fruits of paradise. They belong to someone who does not forget to remember and praise me on the night of power, replied Allah. Prophet Moses then said, O Allah, I wish to have your pleasure and consent. Allah replied, My pleasure and consent belongs to someone who offers two rak'ah prayers during the night of power, that is, two units prayers in the night of Qadr, Laylatul Qadr is that special night, brothers and sisters. Let's benefit the max from this night. Make sure that we are vigilant and awake throughout the night and worshiping Allah.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the night of power, also called Laylatul Qadr. During these nights, one must strive his best to keep thinking about Allah, the glorious, the exalted, all along the night, and should not forget him during any part of the night, even for the sake of recommended and justified deeds. Also, while offering prayer and supplication, he should not think about any other thing, even though they happen to be recommended things. For example, during prayer, the Salah, one should not think about recommended deeds like building of mosque, cleaning of mosque, and paying alms, etc., because all these are indications of negligence. Even during a part of the prayer, he should not think about the next portion of the prayer. Example, in the state of standing, to think about the prostration is negligence. Then what should one do? It seems very difficult, right? Well, these are the advices of Urafa and the mystics and the teachers of Akhlaq, the scholars of Akhlaq. They say that he must try to concentrate upon whatever act of prayer he is performing and should not be negligent about whatever he is doing or reciting. Remember, we have to maximize our potential. Yes, those simple two units prayers would be accepted, inshallah, by the mercy of Allah. But we have to gain as much as we can in this big night. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran,